so many money questions and 1 hour jam-packed in addressing your personal finance questions. You're with us for another edition of On Your Money here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're covering a lot of ground today, from leasing a vehicle to saving when the youngins are young. Kevin McKinley can handle the range. He is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He joins us this morning from WPR Studio in Eau Claire. Hi there, Kevin.
Hello, Kate.
And if you have a personal finance question for Kevin, today is a great day to bring it to the fore. Call in at 800-642-1234. You can send it in an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Well, Kevin, last week we had a special spring membership drive edition of On Your Money, and you offered an On Your Money Mini Money booklet to everyone who pledged to Wisconsin Public Radio. So what were the results like?
The results, Kate, were that the On Your Money listeners stepped up in a big way once again. The On Your Money Mini Money booklet was called 20 Money Moves, and we covered everything from how to figure out how much you needed to have to retire comfortably, how much to spend in retirement, if you should save for retirement or college, how to save money on insurance, all kinds of different topics that people need to know about achieving their own financial security. And in just the one Tuesday pledge show, our goal was an ambitious 250 pledges. And instead, On Your Money listeners came through to the tune of 321 pledges, over $14,000 during a single hour. Thank you so much for those of you who pledged. You're keeping 2018 going with great figures and really wonderful support for On Your Money and Wisconsin Public Radio.
And you, Kevin, are honoring a promise. We're going to use this hour to express our gratitude to the listeners.
For once in my life, I really am going to hold to this promise here, right here. Yes, the entire hour we are going to devote to nothing but answers to your questions that you send in via email at onyourmoney@wpr.org, or send it to me directly at kevin@onyourmoney.com, or you can call in during the show. Kate, is the fax machine on?
What is a fax machine?
The facsimile machine is on. The teletype is working. The homing pigeon roost
is
open.
We'll do some Morse code here, too. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And you can join in with your personal finance question, 800-642-1234. Email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. You can try the facts. I don't know if it will work, but Kevin, are you ready to get started here?
No.
Oh, all right, goodness. Now I am. All right. Get warmed up here. Let's go to Rick in Portage first. Hi, Rick.
Hello. Good morning.
Go ahead.
Good morning. Can you? So I had the happy problem of having some stock that I was gifted back in the 80s. Was sold a few weeks ago. The company was bought out by another company, and the consequence was they sent me this ginormous check, which will count as a capital gain on my taxes. But through going some of the IRS voluminous paperwork, I found mention of something called a specialized small business investment company, and there's a section in instruction 550 that says you can delay the gain on a capital sale if during the 60-day period, beginning on the date of the sale, you buy replacement property, which is common stock of or partnership in an SSBIC. But I have been unable to find any resource which points me towards qualified SSBICs that I could invest in. Do you have any help in finding an investment vehicle like that?
I do not. You can Google it and see if you can come up with it. I don't know of any resources. It's a pretty esoteric concept. And even then, it gets into a danger that some people fall into a trap of where they're trying to avoid capital gains taxes, which is understandable. None of us want to pay any more taxes than we absolutely have to. But they end up investing in an entity or an investment that they otherwise wouldn't invest in. And so I would be very cautious about doing that, because the only way to get around capital gains tax is usually either to not have very much in capital gains, so you can stay below the top of the 12% federal income tax bracket that allows you to be in a 0% capital gains tax bracket, or to lose money or to die. And only one of those things is positive, and two are very negative. And so I'd be very cautious about just saying, well, I'm going to try to invest in something that I can't even find, much less understand the business. It's probably going to be pretty illiquid as well. So, Rick, do you know what the actual dollar bill of the capital gains of the tax would be?
Well, the sum I got was in the neighborhood of about $50,000.
That's how much the gain will be, or how much the tax would be?
That's what the gain will be.
Okay. So, and I'm sorry, are you going to realize that in the 2018 tax year?
Yes, because the sale just happened about a month ago.
Okay. That means that depending on your income, at the most you're probably going to owe on taxes of that is, I'm going to say, maybe $8,000 to $10,000, which is a ton of money if it's lying on the floor. If you're already receiving a gain of that amount, on top of it, it's relatively small, and you might find just the liquidity gap between what you put into an investment and what you get out of it. And by liquidity gap, what I mean by that is, let's say you buy a car from a dealership and it's $10,000, and then you turn around and sell the car the next day. They're not going to give you $10,000 if you take it back to the dealership. They're probably going to give you $9,000. It's going to represent the difference in the profit that the car dealership needs to make. It's the commission that the salesperson receives. And you experience the same thing with illiquid investments, meaning that just if you put $100,000 in an investment, turn around and try to sell it, the cost, the internal drag of the transaction cost might eat up your capital gains tax bill and more, and then you've lost the advantage of having access to those funds as well. So again, I'd definitely pursue it. I don't know any place you can look to find good ones, but I would be cautious about putting money into something that is only trying to sacrifice or trying to avoid the capital gains taxes.
Rick, thanks for the call. Kevin, I didn't think we could segue from illiquid investment to car buying, but you mentioned buying a car a few times over the past few weeks, but some listeners are asking if leasing a vehicle is a better choice.
Yeah, it can be, because when you lease a vehicle, you're only paying for the depreciation during the term of which the lease lasts. So you're only, if you buy, let's say, a $30,000 car, and it's expected to drop in value down to $20,000 over a three-year lease, you only are actually borrowing the $10,000 difference, the depreciation for it. Plus, a newer car is less likely to need repairs than an older one, and the repairs are more likely to be covered under the manufacturer's warranty. Your lower payment on the lease is also going to help you, because if you buy a $30,000 car, you're probably going to have about a $500 loan. But if you just have a $10,000 lease, the loan payment is only going to be probably about $200 or maybe even a little bit more than that. And it won't affect your credit rating as much, because so much of your income won't be going towards the car payment. But even with the lease, as good as it can be, there are a couple chances that leasers can be disappointed.
Like what? Couple chances there.
Well, one of the things that you're seeing a lot right now on TV or newspaper or whatever, you're seeing dealerships where they advertise a very low lease payment for a brand new vehicle, like $199 per month for, say, a 36-month lease. And that is a very good deal. It's great to get into a brand new car and only pay $199 per month. But in smaller print, what they don't highlight is the fact that you have to come up with a down payment of $4,000 or more, maybe plus tax, title, and license on top of that. And if you take your $4,000, let's just say, that you have to come up with as a down payment and divide it out over, let's say, the 36 months of the lease, you're looking at another $110 to $120 per month, which means your new payment is not $199. It's now $325 per month that you're paying over that lease once you consider the money you have to come up with up front.
Well, look what happens when you crunch the numbers there. So what are some other leasing gotchas?
Yeah, well, a lot of people just focus on that payment, that $199, and you should negotiate the price of the car first rather than going in with a payment in mind. And then if you can agree upon a good price for the car, then it's time to talk about the lease. Also, watch the interest rate. leases are loans, and usually there's an interest rate associated with that. Now, it can be very low, especially if the dealership or the factory has some kind of special on the lease interest rate. But it's okay to shop around and talk to your credit union or your bank and say, I'm leasing a vehicle. What kind of interest rate do you charge on a lease loan if I choose to go through you? Also, pay attention to the cost to cancel the lease if you need to before it's up, the cost of any additional miles or wear and tear that you might incur on the vehicle. But the neat thing about leasing a vehicle is you can, of course, still buy the vehicle at the end of the lease, and the purchase price is predetermined. So what you can do is at the end of the lease, you can either say, ooh, this price is now a pretty good deal for this particular vehicle, so I'm going to take advantage of this. Or you can tell the dealer and say, no offense, I can go buy a similar vehicle for $2,000 less than what this residual value is at the end of the lease. Therefore, you can take the car back and I'm going to go over here and buy the different one. And what the dealer will probably say instead is say, well, we don't really want the car back. Therefore, we're going to give it to you for something closer to what you can get elsewhere.
Well, negotiation, give and take in the leasing world. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is here trying to get to as many of your personal finance questions as he humanly can. Let's go back to the phones now with John joining us from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, John.
Good morning, and I really do like the show, I pledge, and Kevin does a great job, as you do also.
He's covered all his bases. Thank you.
Lots of false praise. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. I had to get that in. I'm over 70. I was a teacher for many years, so I have a 403B, not a 401K. I have to have the mandatory withdrawals. Can I get that to go directly to a charity like you can with a 401K?
That's a good question, John. And what you can do is, for people who aren't familiar with this, once you're over 70 and a half, you can, you're required to take required minimum distributions from your retirement plan, like an IRA, but also a 401k or a 403b. You can donate some or all of that to a charity, tax-free, which is an especially large advantage right now because most people in that situation do not have enough itemizable deductions to exceed the standard deduction. And by being able to donate it tax-free, you not only save yourself some money in income taxes, but you also can make sure that your income doesn't go over certain thresholds that can make Social Security taxable or cause you to lose out on other tax credits. So the good news is you can do it. The bad news is that you have to do it by rolling the money over to an IRA first, and then any dollar amount can come out of it. Have you considered that, John, or is that something that that you just as soon not do?
I'm not sure. At this point, courtesy of my employer many years ago, I don't think I am paying any fees for having the account.
Okay. That could be. There are fees associated with the account, meaning that, like, the investments within the 403B there are internal expenses that are dinging your return. It might be relatively small, but usually with 403Bs, unless it's a low-cost provider like Vanguard or Fidelity or Schwab, and sometimes even those can be higher expenses, you probably are paying fees on it. What you can do, though, John, is that you can move. Let's say you decided you wanted to move $3,000 from your 403B to a charity to satisfy the RMD. You can move the money, whatever you want to move, to the $3,000 to the IRA, and then roll that over, and then have that pass directly onto it. The bad news about it, though, is you have to take RMDs separately from different categories of retirement accounts, like. If you have five different IRAs, you can take the RMD for those five different IRAs from just one IRA if you want. But if you have an IRA and a 403B, you have to then pull some out of the 403B every single year for the RMD, and that part you can't donate to the charity. So unless you're willing to move it all the way over to an IRA, and there are very low-cost providers that you can find, as I mentioned, who are willing to do that for you, but the benefit to doing that might exceed, say, an advantage you might have in terms of the investments within the 403B. Sometimes there are stable value accounts in the 403B or fixed rate annuities that you can't get on your own elsewhere. And if that's the case, I'd just as soon have you leave it in that 403B and donate the money in some other manner.
John, thanks for the call. You are with us for a special edition of On Your Money, where your money questions are front and center thanks to a very successful spring membership drive. Kevin McKinley is answering as many of your questions as possible. He's a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Stay with us for more On Your Money. We'll be back in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. There are two words that begin with the letter D that suck up a whole lot of cash when the kiddos are young: daycare and diapers. We'll get to a question later this hour about saving when the kids are young on this edition of On Your Money. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Kevin McKinley is in the house. He's a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. And you've got a line to Kevin, 800-642-1234. If you have a personal finance question, you can ship it our way to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Kevin, here's a question from a listener in the Milwaukee area who says, love your show. My husband and I got married about 6 months ago, have yet to create a joint financial plan. I've tried creating a spreadsheet and budget, but it never stuck for us. I know we could be saving more money than we currently are, especially if we join our incomes together and create a shared goal. I think at this point we would do best sitting down with a professional who can look at all of our accounts, debt, retirement savings, and goals, who could help us create a plan we could stick to. Do you have any advice for how we can go about finding the best financial planner to work with, who will also won't cost us a ton of money?
Oh, I love this question for lots of reasons. One of which is she went off with false praise. That's the first one. But more importantly, she is acknowledging the need for improvement. She is attempting to bring her husband in to work together to achieve common goals. And she's recognizing that starting early in life, and this is very early in life, is the key to becoming financially independent down the road. Time is a much bigger asset in terms of becoming financially independent than actual money, because usually if you start early with a little bit of money, it's a lot better than trying to start late with a lot of money.
So what suggestions would you give to her?
Well, there are ways that you can shop around for a financial planner in a specific geographic area. A couple of the websites are letsmakeaplan.org, find an advisor at napfa.org, and plannersearch.org. And we'll have links to those websites at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today. Now, what the caller or the listener actually probably needs here is an hourly financial planner, maybe a set fee, where you go into the person, you give the information that the planner is looking for, and then they give you a financial plan that makes some projections based on what you're doing right now, what you're spending, how much you're saving, and tells you what the next maybe 30 or 40 years might look like, and then gives you some steps that you hopefully will take now to increase your odds of doing well. But they need to ask beforehand not only if the person will help them in that manner, but also how much it might cost. And you can probably expect to spend somewhere around $500 to $3,000 for a wide range of financial plans. For most younger couples starting out, I'd put it in the $500 to $1,000 range, and hopefully you'll get enough information out of that where it will more than offset that cost, maybe in the savings of taxes or interest rates or savings on debt. And you might even just get some peace of mind to say, no, you're really doing everything you need to. Just keep doing, maybe make a few tweaks here and there.
So will the planner be able to get these newlyweds on the right track?
Yeah, that's another part of this question that's more interesting, because there's a little hint there that maybe we're not doing as well as we should in terms of meeting our goals for saving. And this is kind of like asking a dietitian how to lose weight. The dietitian is going to say, you know, eat less and eat healthier and get some exercise. But it's up to you to actually make the changes. And it's the same thing with the questioner and her husband. There's all kinds of things that people like me can say that you should do. But until you're actually willing to do it and make the changes, the advice is worthless and you end up wasting your money with a financial planner. So what I would recommend is that they sit down start with themselves and don't even go to the financial planner first and identify expenditures that they're making that it's okay to make, like, you know, buying gas and for the car. That's something that's hard to get out of unless you can bike or take public transportation. So gas and basic food is probably a necessity. But maybe going out to eat too often, like two or three times a week, is eating a hole in their budget. So that might be something to reduce. So after they identify the okay expenditures, eliminate everything else they possibly can, and then redirect their savings into these goals. First of all, try to get 3 months worth of living expenses set up. If you spend $5,000 a month times three, that's $15,000. That can help protect you in an emergency. Then take any other money you have left over and make sure you get any matching contributions to your retirement plan from your employer. And after you've achieved that goal, then start paying down debt. And that's debt that has any interest rate that's usually in the double digits or more, so more than 10%. And often that's going to be credit card debt, student loans, car loans, mortgages that have lower interest rates. You can hold off on those until you can contribute more into your retirement plan. Specifically, I'd like to see them get below the top of the 12% federal income tax bracket with their pre-tax retirement plan contributions. That would be IRAs, 401ks, or 403bs. And in terms of just a rough dollar amount to give people an idea of what they should be saving for a year, if you're a young couple, if you can each save $5,000 a year into any type of retirement account, a 401k, a 403b, or a Roth IRA, that's a really good start.
Great advice there. Let's go back to the phones now with Christina, who has been waiting a while in Glenwood City. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. Well, I hope the wise counselor can solve a marital dispute.
Our yes, I can guarantee. No matter, even if it's not financially related, Christina.
Well, I called the right person. Our $6,000 equity note is due, and my husband says we should pay it off to save the $35 annual fee and then the interest rate. I say that we should refinance it and get more money to save for unknowns such as repairs, or we should check to see what a 30-year mortgage rate is compared to our current and then get even more money to save for unknowns.
Yeah, Christina, actually, that what you're talking about is a relatively sophisticated concept that in the right timing can be a good idea for people who say, well, we have really no savings. Our income is either non-existent or it's relatively precarious. We don't know what we'd do if we ran into some kind of $5,000 or $10,000 emergency because we have no cash whatsoever. Those people should definitely not pay your mortgage off any faster than you have to. And you may want to consider getting a new 30-year fixed rate mortgage for no more than 80% of the value of the home. And then parking the money. Now, you're going to lose out on the interest cost of it. And that's right now is going to be about 4 to 4.5%, depending on your situation. But you might be able to make a little bit of that back in terms of a savings account if you can find one that pays you. Rates have come up, so you probably could get 1, maybe 2% if you're lucky on that. And then the other part of that is just having access to that money. So that is something that I would consider. But from what you've told me right now, it wouldn't be my first bet. What I'd rather have you do is go to the bank first and see if you can get what's known as a home equity line of credit. Is that something you have now, or is it just a home equity loan you're looking to pay off?
Well, it's the loan that we're looking to pay off.
Okay. If you're able to pay it off, you can save yourself the interest. And then what you want to do, though, is you want to establish a home equity line of credit for as much as the lender will allow. If you have a $200,000 house, that might be 50 or 60% of the value. And what that does, Christina, it might cost a little bit to set it up. It might cost a little bit in fees to maintain, but it will give you access to that equity at any time you want it without having to go back to the bank and borrow money because you're just going to tap it as you need it. And usually it's just for emergencies. Like, let's say you need a new roof or something. You don't have the cash to pay for it. A lot of people would choose to tap that home equity line of credit to pay for the roof. You only pay interest on what you borrow. And the interest rate, although it can fluctuate, they're very low right now. They're usually in the 4 to 5% range as well. And that's something I would do is if you want to get out of the debt and avoid the interest cost, I'm okay with paying it off, but I would definitely want you to have a home equity line of credit established so that if the need arises, you can go back in and get access to that in an emergency.
Christina, good luck. Thanks for calling. You are with us for a very special edition of On Your Money. Kevin McKinley getting to so many questions this hour as a promise and a thanks to having a very successful spring membership drive. You can join in the conversation with your question, your money-related question, at 800-642-1234. Email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kevin, you're going to get a kick out of this one. Michelle emails, "Good morning. I love this show, and I'm wondering if I can adopt Kevin McKinley."
Yeah, actually, if you get in touch with my parents, I think even at my advanced age, they'd be more than willing to pass on the parental rights. We've had a good 52-year run, and they're probably tired of it and are just about ready to do it. So sure, let's get those papers started.
Well, alas, she does segue into a question. Until we work out the paperwork on that, her question is, as a Yonkers, now defunct, credit card holder, what is my best option in regards to my credit score? Shall I cancel the card or just let it go, cutting it up as it's no longer usable? I have no balance.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about that in a couple of weeks because there are a lot of retailers that are very precarious or have just said we are closing stores left and right. We may not be around a year from now. And so that can affect a lot of shoppers and would-be shoppers in surprising ways. I would cancel the card. And I would make sure that the credit bureaus report that you have canceled the card, because that will have a tendency to hurt your score less than if it gets on there that the card was canceled by them due to your behavior. It's unlikely that will happen in a situation like this, but I'd cancel the card, and if you it won't hurt your credit score greatly. It might a little bit. The way that it hurts the credit score is the credit bureaus look at your overall available credit, and then the percentage of it that you use is tied into your score. So if you have $20,000 of overall credit available to you, but you've only used $2,000, that'll help your score. If you cancel a card that has $5,000 but no balance, now your available credit is $15,000 and you still have a $2,000 balance. So you're using a greater percentage of your available credit. Again, it's not going to affect it a lot. And in fact, I'd be cautious even about opening up a new card just to help your credit score, unless it's a low score and you're trying to build it back up for a bigger loan in the future. If that's the case, don't go with a department store card. Go with just a traditional MasterCard or Visa or Discover card. And those are usually a better deal in terms of fees and interest rates. And sometimes they'll give you more in the way of miles or points. And you're better off getting a generic card rather than a specific department store card.
And Michelle, good luck with that adoption. Here is a question from Trina, who says, my two children, who are 3 and 6, were just gifted a decent amount of money for them to use as we feel fit. We already contribute to their Edvest accounts monthly. We don't want to up all of their money in the Edvest accounts, but we also don't want to hurt any potential need-based financial aid they might be eligible for, although it's unlikely they would be eligible for need-based money. We were thinking of opening youth savings accounts. Are savings accounts a good idea? The extra gift money will probably occur annually for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, well, congratulations, Trina. That's a great problem to have here. I wouldn't have you save in the kids' name just yet, in part because you never know what's going to happen down the road in terms of your own financial situation and these other gifts that may or may not be coming. The kids may still need to try to get need-based financial aid for college, and any money that's in the kids' name really hurts the need-based financial aid. Also, if you put it in the kid's name now, generally the kid takes over control of the accounts when she reaches 18 or 21, depending on the state of residence. And then tax reporting for money that's earned in a child's name is very complicated. And again, until the child takes over for it, it's a real pain to file what they call the kiddie tax returns and to calculate it. Never. So it can really be a drag every single year for just a few dollars of interest in taxes.
So what would you suggest instead?
I'd like to see a two-pronged approach where the parents would actually keep the money in their own names, at least for the time being, and put half into some kind of low-cost index stock fund like Vanguard or some other type of, again, very low-cost fund, and also one that's unlikely to make lots of taxable distributions that the parents will have to pay taxes on it. And then down the road, they can give it to the kids if they want. They can, right now, they can gift up to $14,000 per year, or they can spend it on the kids if they need it. Let's say the kids need to go to band camp, or you know, they're taking a school trip overseas or something, or the kids need a car. And one thing I could see happening is if the kids do work while they're in high school or even college, the parents could use that money to contribute to Roth IRAs for the children, and then they can put it in the kids' names. But by then they'll have a better idea of how responsible the kids are as they'll be a little bit older.
And so what about the other half?
The other half, put it in something safe like Series I savings bonds. They can buy up to $10,000 per person per year. And the cool thing about that is, first of all, these are very safe bonds. Second of all, they pay an interest rate that does fluctuate every 6 months. The most recent rate was 2.58%. And if they keep the bonds in the parents' name, they can use the proceeds tax-free for qualified higher education expenses if they meet certain income limits, which are available to most middle and even upper middle income families. And so if you split it between the stock funds and the savings bonds, you're going to have something that's very safe, not going to pay very much, but it'll be tax advantaged. And in the stock funds, you hopefully get that better rate of return. And then as the kids get older, then I would decide if and when you're actually going to gift it to the kids. And it might be something that doesn't occur until they're 25 or 30. It might be to pay for a wedding. It might be for a down payment on a house, or again, to help them save for their own retirement once they get jobs.
Well, it sounds like a plan, Kevin McKinley. Let's go back to the phones now with Moni in Madison. Hi, Moni.
Yeah, I got some of the answers from the previous question, but I have a question on a custodian account for kids. So is it a good idea, or whatever you said is the one that to follow?
Yeah, is it? Are your children under the age of 18, Moni?
Yes, they okay. are like... Younger ones. One is four.
Okay. And are you thinking about saving for college specifically, or is there some broader goal that you're trying to achieve?
Just for their college or for their higher education.
Okay. And you're a Wisconsin resident, correct?
Yes.
Okay. What I would look at, the best tool for that specific purpose, in my opinion, is the EdVest College Savings Account, EDVEST. And what that does, Moni, is it allows you to put money aside in the account. You will get a small Wisconsin state income tax deduction on some of the deposit, a little over $3,000 per kid. And if that's for each year. If you put $3,000 in, you'll probably save about $100 to $150 in your state income taxes. And then you maintain control over the money. You can choose from a roster of investments, kind of like an at-work 401k or 403b. You can pick aggressive ones or conservative ones. And then the money, any earnings that it has, are sheltered from taxation. And then once they reach college age or beyond, if they decide to go to college, you can then pull money out of that EdVest account tax-free to pay for qualified higher education expenses. And if for some reason they don't need the money, or they're not going to go to college, or you just don't feel like helping them out, you can transfer the funds to another family member so that that person can use them. Or you can pull them out and use them yourself. But if you use it for a non-qualified expense, you're going to pay taxes on whatever earnings you withdraw, plus a 10% penalty. But it is only on the earnings portion. So the taxes and penalties are going to be relatively small.
Moni, thanks so much for calling in. Let's now go to Jonathan, who is waiting in Milwaukee. Hi, Jonathan. What's your question?
Hi. I was wondering... I am in college right now. I am a senior. I'll be graduating in the spring. And my fiance, she works a full-time job, but we will be having two children in daycare the following summer after my graduation. And we were just wondering how we could save without taking out, you know, too many loans or anything like that.
Right. Are you looking to save for childcare expenses, Jonathan, or just for everything?
Probably both, but mostly I'm just worried about the childcare because we will have two children in daycare as opposed to the one we have now, usually
right.
daycare.
Yeah, just for other people who are maybe a couple years behind you in the progression of life, Jonathan, about what are you paying per month for childcare for one child?
It's about $900, I believe, a month.
It's a lot of money, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. The good news is if the kids can eventually go to school, especially if they go to public school, your costs will go down after they age into kindergarten. But it's going to be a ton of money for that, too. There are a couple of things you can use to save for it that provide pre-tax benefits, like much like the Edvest account or retirement accounts we just talked about, where you can put in money pre-tax into a dependent care account and then pull it out tax-free to pay for qualified child care expenses. And you do also get a tax credit for having the children. But if your income isn't very high, that really isn't a lot to offset that, because you're not paying that much in taxes anyway. So that will save you a little bit of money, especially when you start earning money and paying taxes. But in the meantime, I'd look at a couple different options for it. One of the things that I would do, and we actually did this with our kids when they were younger, is we looked at daycare for our children, and we ran into the same issue that you have, where we said, gosh, that's an awful lot of money. At $900 a month, that works out to $10,000, $12,000 a year, and that's just for one kid. Now, usually most daycare facilities don't double it up. They give you a slight discount for multiple children. But what we decided to do is we actually were lucky enough to live in a college town, so we had lots of college students, and we would just put an ad up on the job board, and some very bright-eyed elementary education or nursing or FIAT or music major would answer the ad to come to our home and take care of the kids. And this person would usually have a car, they'd be great references, and the cost was actually lower than what we would have paid had we had daycare. And we had the advantage of keeping the kids in our own home and being there rather than having to go through the issue of dropping them off and picking them up. And so, and then you can also you can get two or three different students sometimes to fit into different holes in the schedule rather than having to pay for 8 hours a day of care or 10 hours a day of care, depending on your schedule. So there's really not much you can do other than try to find the lowest cost one, or look at seeing if you can, if it's less expensive and more convenient even to have someone come into your home instead.
Well, Jonathan, good luck in bringing those little ones into the fold. So many money-related questions in life. One show that tries to channel all those questions into some really helpful and practical advice. It is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Your questions are always welcome at 800-642-1234. What's the money question that's been weighing on your mind? We'll get to it. Try to work through it. Just stay with us here on the Ideas Network. This is a special spring pledge thank you edition of On Your Money. The drive was so successful, you came through, and that means Kevin McKinley wants to tackle as many of your pressing financial questions as possible this hour. Kevin McKinley is in the house. He's a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. Get your question in the hopper at 800-642-1234. You can type it up in an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Or, as always, tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Kevin, John asks, once I reach 62, can I delay my Social Security? I'm eligible for full benefits at 66 years old and 10 months. I understand that I do not have to wait to receive full Social Security at 66 years and 10 months, that if I wait until age 63, 64, or 65, I would have greater Social Security benefits each year I delay until getting full benefits at that mark of 66 years and 10 months. Can you explain this to me?
Yes. Oh, that wasn't the question. Okay. Yes, I can and I will. John, thank you for asking. Social Security and retirement, you can first usually take it at 62, especially if it's your own benefit which you're receiving. But if you don't take it, the amount that you receive generally increases every single year by a factor of 8%, depending on the situation. Once you reach full retirement age, which in John's case apparently is 66 years and 10 months, a couple nice things happen. One is that you may be able to get a spousal benefit in full for your spouse if he or she is also a full retirement age. More importantly, the Social Security that you earn is not reduced if you have other earnings, not interest or income from investments or anything, but from actual earnings. Anything under full retirement age, if you get if you're working, you actually get hit a little bit if you are accepting Social Security benefits under that full retirement age. And then it stops increasing by that 8% factor at age 70. So it usually doesn't make any sense at all to continue waiting past age 70 to take your retirement benefits.
So when should someone take Social Security at the end of the day?
It's actually a very simple question. It's not easy to answer. All you have to do is tell me when you are going to die, and I will tell you when to take Social Security. You need to make it usually to about age 80 to make any waiting make sense. So if you're 62 and you're thinking about taking it, ask yourself, am I going to live to 80? If I am, on paper anyway, it probably makes sense to wait to take it and get the higher check. But again, if you are working and you're eligible, you're over 62, but under your full retirement age, remember that not only will the Social Security benefits be piled on top of your earned income and therefore taxed at a higher rate, but you could lose 50 cents for every dollar over about $17,000 of earnings that you have. So if you make, let's say, $30,000 and you're under full retirement age and you're collecting Social Security, you might lose about $6,000 of the Social Security benefits because your earnings exceed that $17,000 so threshold. Now, you do get those back in the form of a higher check eventually once you're at full retirement age. But it still is something that's painful for people to experience if they just notice the big hit.
Well, another but here, the increased payment amount is a good rate of return.
Right, 8%. A lot of people say to me, well, Kevin, I'm getting 8% by waiting. I can't get 8% guaranteed anywhere else, so this is a really good deal. I'm going to wait. And it is true that the checks are indeed 8% higher if you wait a year. So if you were expecting a $1,000 check and then you wait a year, your checks will now be $1,080. But it's not as good as it appears because you have to remember you've foregone 1 year's worth of Social Security checks. So go back to my example here. If you were getting $1,000 a month and you said, no, I'm going to wait a year so I can get $1,080 a month a year from now, you've missed $12,000 worth of benefits over that year time, and you have to get the new higher, slightly higher check for a long time to make up for the big difference. In the actual rate of return, I've seen several different studies of this, the actual rate of return that you get by waiting to take Social Security is closer to maybe 3 to 4% per year for each year that you wait. Now, that's still pretty good, but it's not 8%.
Let's go back to the phones now, Kevin, with Bill waiting in Green Mill. Hi, Bill.
Hello, how are you? Ma'am, what I'm interested in is being someone who's over 70 and I have a lot of money in IRAs with the 4-year window that the politicians have given me for reduced taxes. Would it be beneficial to me to roll more money out of my IRAs into Roth IRAs?
Sure, Bill. What you're saying is you're saying that because the tax brackets for individuals have been lowered somewhat, is it a good time now to convert IRAs to Roth IRAs and pay the taxes on that amount, but then be done paying taxes on it for as long as you live, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, that's a good thing that you're considering this and that you're taking into account the fact that, hey, this could be a nice window here. And we don't know if it's going to be 4 years. It could be forever. It could be a year, depending on what changes are made to the tax code. What I'd always try to do, Bill, for you and everybody else out there is if you're considering this, I try to flatten your federal income tax bracket by always trying to get your income up to the 12% federal income tax bracket ceiling, but never over that. So if you think there's an amount that you can convert that keeps it in that 12% bracket, you're probably okay to do it. If it's going to push you up into the 22% bracket artificially, it's probably not a good idea. And to give you an idea of how this will work, for married couples filing jointly, usually if you have about $100,000 of gross income, anything over that is going to put you in the 22% federal income tax bracket. Anything under that, the most it will be taxed at is 12%. For single filers, the figure is about half of that. It's not the $100,000, it's about $50,000. So if you think, well, gee, between Social Security and maybe my RMDs, I'm at $40,000 of income as a single filer, you might want to think about converting another $10,000 or so to from the IRA to the Roth IRA and still stay below the top of that bracket. But keep in mind that sometimes the conversion and the extra income that can then pile on top of that and make your Social Security more taxable might cause you to lose some other deductions. So be cautious about doing that just based on my pithy advice.
Bill, thanks so much for the call. Let's stay in the neighborhood with Alan calling from Wisconsin Dells with a question. Hi, Alan.
Good morning. I am going to be turning 70 and a half in December this year, and I understand all the rules about making, you know, your required minimum deductions on my regular IRA that I have, IRAs. My question concerns the fact that I became a public employee at a rather late age, 58 years old, when I became covered by the trust funds, Wisconsin Department of Employee Trust Funds. So their rules allowed me to take extra money for retirement, which I did, and above and beyond my regular retirement that I was getting through the employee trust funds. So my question is, it's a separate amount of money, and let's just say it's $200,000. Whenever I want to withdraw from that, they have said they will take out 20% of anything I request. So if I take out, you know, $10,000, they're going to take out 20% of that and pay it into the federal government. My question is, does that fund hit the same requirements as a IRA?
And Alan, we're going to have to cut you short here because we're short on time. Kevin, any advice there?
Yeah, I couldn't quite get enough of the information from it to tell you for sure, Alan. But tell you what, if you want to email the question to me at kevin@onyourmoney.com, I'll be able to answer it. But yes, other types of 457 plans do have similar RMDs, not quite the same in terms of getting the money out and distributions for it. And if you're still working for the employer, oftentimes you don't have to take the RMD even if you're over 70 and a half. But send me the question if you want, and I'll try to answer it that way.
And Kevin, what is the website of the week?
The website of the week is one of our favorites. We've had a lot of people asking about how can we save money. Well, go to You Need a Budget, and you can either type in youneedabudget.com or just YNAB.com, YNAB.com. It started out as a very simple program that you could buy for $30 or so, and it's expanded out to not only a program that you can use to track your spending, you can do it automatically or have it enter it in on your own so you can keep your data private. But there's also classes there as well that you can learn about budgeting and saving and investing and how to handle debt. YNAB.com, youneedabudget.com, and we'll have that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC. On Your Money can be heard on the Ideas Network Tuesday mornings at 8. It's rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. And this edition of On Your Money, this Thank You Spring Pledge edition, was produced by Keely Baltina and Brianne Chasso. Michael Derringer provided technical direction. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.